On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hot young black poet Kevin Young was born in Nebraska, raised in Kansas, descended from Louisiana folk, and now lives in Atlanta and Boston. His poetry, like his life, spans regions, worlds, and genres. In Black Mariah, he evoked film noir. In Jelly Roll, his poetry danced with the blues. Now, this African-American son of bayou and plains is taking on the inevitable, the undying history. His new collection is For the Confederate Dead. The title evokes Robert Lowell's For the Union Dead, but this is a black man in 2007 weighing the Confederacy with a view all his own and more. East Jesus, West Hell, Lionel Hampton in Paris. Up next on Point, Kevin Young and For the Confederate Dead. I'm joined from Atlanta by poet Kevin Young. He's 36. His first collection in 1995, Most Way Home, was selected for the National Poetry Series. His second collection, To Repel Ghosts, was an exploration of the life and times of the New York painter Jean-Michel Basquiat. In 2003 came Jelly Roll, a book of blues-based love poems, a finalist for the National Book Award. Black Mariah, in 2005, was film noir in verse. He's professor of English and creative writing at Emory University, and his latest book is For the Confederate Dead. Kevin Young, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
Hello. Wonderful to have you.
But it's great to be here.
Robert Lowell wrote For the Union Dead. Was the poem in your mind when you wrote this one?
It was. Funny enough, my middle name is Lowell, no relation, but I always was thinking of that poem, which I think is a terrific poem about its time, the 1960s, and dealing with civil rights. And I want to write a poem both in honor of it and also sort of questioning some of, I guess, the gains and losses since that time.
Help us put all this in context. Describe that poem just a bit for us, if you would, before we hear your For the Confederate Dead, so we can understand the contrast. For the Union Dead by Robert Lowell, written when, and give us the background.
Well, the poem, I believe it first appeared in Life Studies as a sort of coda, and then he built a whole separate collection after it. So it was actually probably the late 50s. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact date on me. But in my experience, the poem is a poem that deals with sort of the famous 54th and the death of the black soldiers fighting for the North.
This is from people may remember it from the movie Glory. Of course, people in Boston
Glory.
Know it well from the wonderful sculpture St. Gaudens there across from the State House that shows Robert Shaw, the white commander, marching off to Civil War with his black troops. If you'll permit me, Kevin Young, I've got just a little bit of Robert Lowell's poem For the Union Dead.
Please.
Read here by Robert Pinsky. Just an excerpt. Let's listen.
2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel is as lean as a compass needle. He has an angry, wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gentle tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky reading there from Robert Lowell's 1960, I guess, poem For the Union Dead. In his new collection, Kevin Young picks up. His poem is For the Confederate Dead. We want to hear you read it, but set us up just a little to help us understand what you're going to read, Kevin.
Well, the poem, I guess, is set in a cafe of sorts in the South, and there's a mention of a mural, which I guess in my poem sort of becomes the bronze, as it were, of Lowell's, which actually existed. And I think both poems are about excavation, history, and troubling the water of that. For me, the title is both homage and irony, both of the Confederacy and also of Lowell himself.
Could you read your poem For the Confederate Dead? Kevin Young here from the collection of the same name.
For the Confederate Dead, there's an epigraph from Whitman. I go with the team also. For the Confederate Dead, These are the last days, my television says. Tornadoes, more rain, overcast, a chance of sun, but I do not trust weathermen, never have. In my fridge, only the milk makes sense, expires. No one, much less my parents, can tell me why my middle name is Lowell, and from my table, across from the Confederate monument to the dead, that pale finger bone, a plaque declares war, not civil or between the states, but for Southern independence. In this cafe, below sea and eye level, a mural runs the wall, flaking, a plantation scene most do not see. It's too much around the knees, height of a child. In its fields, Negroes bend to pick the endless white. In livery, a few drive carriages like slaves, whipping the horses, faces blank and peeling. The old hotel lobby this once was no longer welcomes guests. Maroon ledger, bellboy's gone, but for this. Like an inheritance, the owner found it, stripping 100 years, at least, of paint and plaster. More leaves each day. In my movie, there are no horses, no heroes, only draftees fleeing into the pines, some few who survive, gravely wounded, lying burrowed beneath the dead, silent until the enemy bayonets what is believed to be the last of the breathing. It is getting later. We prepare for wars no longer there. The weather, inevitable, unusual, more this time of year than anyone ever seed. The earth shudders, the air. If I did not know better, I would think we were living all along a fault. How late it has gotten. Forget the weatherman whose maps move, blink, but stay crossed with lines none has seen. Race instead against the almost rain, digging beside the monument, that giant anchor, till we strike water, sweat, fighting the sleepwalking air.
Kevin Young reading from his new collection of poems. There, the poem For the Confederate Dead, also the title of the collection. You're a time traveler here. You've got bayonets and movies and weathermen all in the same bundle. Are you looking to travel into history or to sew together different points in time?
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. I think that the sort of quilt, as it were, of history is always over us. It's always, it might be in a drawer or a trunk somewhere, but it's always there. And I think that in the poem, the speaker, who I think is me, is experiencing that moment of the monuments all around us that we often walk past and don't take notice of, and things like the weather, and those strange maps which have all these lines. And I think in the poem, the poet is reflecting on these lines, much like race or much like the Mason-Dixon line, that are sort of invisible but affect us nonetheless. And I think the weather plays like that too. I think, you know, it was one of those humid, sticky days, and that feeling of the sleepwalking air that is both physical and, I guess, metaphoric.
So it's a nod to Robert Lowell's poem For the Union Dead, but it's also yours in your title. When you write For the Confederate Dead, which dead? Who?
Well, that's a great question. I wrestled a lot with the title for the whole collection, but I think as the collection, it points to some other ideas of Confederacy or what it means to be a Confederate. And, you know, it opens with a poem for Gwendolyn Brooks. And that, I think, sort of sets the tone for a book that considers all these different people as Confederates, whether it's Robert Lowell in some way, but Gwendolyn Brooks directly is mentioned in the book, Marian Anderson, the famous singer who wasn't allowed to sing by the Daughters of the American Revolution. There's another poem for Garcia Lorca, so the famous Spanish poet who was shot and killed. So they're poems about, I guess, history and our place in it, and also about my friends. I mean, there's a long poem for my friend Philippe Wamba, who died in a car crash at age 31, and sort of to make him part of this, I guess I hesitate to say Confederacy, but I think that's what it is, was an important part of the book.
So are you redefining Confederacy then to make it your own Confederacy of souls? What about the capital C Confederates, the capital C Confederacy, the white Confederate dead? Is that part of your poetic embrace too or not?
I think in part. I think that, I'm trying to, it's hard to try to change a word. I mean, mm-hmm. words change all around us, but it's hard to try to do it purposefully. But I think in some way that's what I'm trying to do, expand and explore this word, which I think is tough. You know, it's a tough word for some people, but I also think we can't turn away from it. And I did want that, I guess that contrast between that's on the cover of the soldiers resting, which is sort of a fascinating moment we don't often think of.
Black soldiers, cowboy hats, guitars, Union uniforms, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, resting in between. And, you know, there's also sort of a war going on, so that sort of echoes for me a little bit too.
Kevin, you've got some really grabbing titles here. I'd love to hear more. You've got East Jesus, you've got West Hell. Maybe West Hell would be something you might read for us.
Yeah, we can visit there for just a moment.
Great.
The poem takes as its title West Hell, which is sort of in black folklore a term for sort of out of the way place, or and a lot of those poems in the section called Americana take their impetus from Zora Neale Hurston, the famous folklorist and writer. Mm. So this is West Hell. Sin, thy name is this weight, this place, a long ways from here to there, from somewhere last we were in love or lust or not even close. It's hot most the year, and noon this town shuts doors down. The bass burrowing in the bottom, even our mudfish with nowheres to go. The days dry as envy, we trawl the shallows and perfect our lies. The morning's catch we could have landed, the ladies or men's jealousies we wear as badge, avoid not at all. How humid the heart, its messy rooms. We eat spicy food, sweat like wood, and smolder like the coal mine that caught fire decades ago, yet still smokes more than my great uncle, who will not quit or go out.
Kevin Young reading West Hell there from his new collection, The Confederate Dead, with bass burrowing and days dry as envy. It's wonderful. Let me take a call, if I may, from Nashville. Jeannie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Kevin, I'm thrilled to talk with you because we have a mutual friend in Nashville, Jen Gunderman.
Oh, great.
I think.
Yes, Jen's old friend.
Yeah. Well, she's a creative talent also, and so my question for you is, when did you know you had a talent with words, and when did your poetic gift manifest itself?
That's a great question. I hope it's manifested itself already. I'm not sure sometimes, but I think that for me, my writing began before I was comfortable with being a poet. It was sort of a strange thing. I didn't know many poets, or if any, growing up. But when I was in middle school or so, about 12 or 13, I took a poetry class in Kansas where I lived, which was more a creative writing class. We wrote fiction and poetry. And, you know, the teacher kept passing around my poems that I'd written like the day before. And I thought, this is curious. And I really fell in love with poetry and just began writing it on my own. And then by the time I got to college, I'd sort of gone through, I guess, what I think of as an apprenticeship, and started writing poems really about my family, who are all from Louisiana. And that was really, I think, the start of my mature work that became my first book, Most Way Home.
A lot of spanning there, from Louisiana to that university. I think you went to Harvard. Seamus Heaney was one of your teachers. We had him on the show recently. You got a big wingspan there, from Louisiana and Kansas and Nebraska to the shades of Robert Lowell and Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, and I think that that's what makes a poet, is a lot of different things and a wingspan, as you say. That, and I think a sort of point of view, but that it's so personal that you don't realize it's different. At least I didn't. I thought everyone's parents were from Louisiana and they lived in Kansas and right. liked poetry. So for me to go somewhere and find out that was sort of different was great. I helped me to focus and see that I could write about my family as a subject matter, and more specifically about the way they talked. I love the way that folks in my family talk and the way that people talk. And I think my first book was a lot about the way they told stories or didn't tell stories, the things they leave out. And then I think my second book was much about sort of city talk and the way mm-hmm. we're surrounded by signs and a bustling life and music and noise. And so that combination of music and silence and noise, I think, really helps make a poet.
We'll look at music. There's a lot of musical touchstones tumbling through here. Jeannie in Nashville, thanks very much for calling. Kevin
Thanks,
Young,
Jeannie.
I want to invite another voice in, if I may, for just a minute here. Joining us from Westchester County in New York is Billy Collins. He was U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003, professor of English at Lehman College at the City University of New York, a writer in residence at Sarah Lawrence College. His latest collection is The Trouble with Poetry and Other Poems. Billy Collins, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom and Kevin.
You've had great words for Kevin Young. You're the poet laureate, and you describe his work, I guess it was in Jelly Roll, as tender and sassy and just plain cool. What do you read in Kevin Young's work, Billy?
Well, I didn't realize you were still up and coming. I thought you'd arrived.
Okay.
I didn't know you were the hot new voice, but well, that's the book I love the best of his, or the most familiar with, Jelly Roll. As you were just saying, I think Kevin, I'm talking to you, it's called to you in the third person here, but he lets a lot of the talk and noise of the world into his poems instead of filtering them out and committing a kind of delicate act of literature. So you can hear the rhythms of speech and traffic and musical instruments and all sorts of things in his poetry. I mean, it's kind of a cliche that poetry aspires to music with the other arts. But especially in Jelly Roll, every poem title has something to do with music. I mean, there's anthem and there's shuffle and requiem. It's almost like having a shuffle on your stereo, where you can each poem goes from one kind of music to the other. Ragtime.
That's great. Blues. Yeah.
And it's that kind of, and it's he's cool. That's another thing. And it's very
what makes him cool, Billy? That's the most ephemeral thing.
Because he doesn't seem to try to be cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but that's kind of the definition of cool, right? If you try to be cool, that you fail at being cool.
He's also very prolific. Kevin Young, he's right here with us, but he's got a lot out there already. You say up and coming, what the heck? He's arrived. What marks a poet's arrival these days in this culture?
I don't know. I wish he'd slow down, though. there's too much out there. Take a break, buddy. Well, I don't know. I think the kind of exposure that he's getting now, he's becoming a he has an original voice. I mean, how do you take this beat up language of English, this 6-pound dictionary that lies on your table?
Yeah.
How do you put your intelligence into that and actually create a voice that's different from anybody else's voice? It's like picking up the saxophone and being able to play in a distinctive style. And I think Kevin Young has a distinctive verbal style, which is an amazing accomplishment in itself.
Kevin, are you willing to take the accolade there?
Well, thank you very much. And it's nice to talk to you. I haven't gotten a chance to, so
I'm glad I don't have to look at your expression when I'm complimenting you. Right?
Tender, sassy, and just plain cool. Billy Collins, a former U.S. Poet Laureate, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us for a minute here.
You're very welcome. Good luck, Kevin.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Let me take a call from Dorchester, Massachusetts, and Rhonda. Hi, Rhonda. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm calling, I guess my question is basically about language. I was listening to the promos for Mr. Young's introduction for this segment, and all of the promos mentioned that he was African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, how is this significant to his presence on the show today? And I'm wondering also if Mr. Young could respond to, I guess, the common debate for black writers and artists. You know, are you an artist who is black or a black artist?
You know, I'm so glad you raised that, because it was just at this table, 2 or 3 hours ago, where we sat thinking about the show and how we would introduce Kevin Young and whether or not to say, young black poet or just poet. And we went back and forth and we decided, we're looking at the cover of the book, it's For the Confederate Dead, and the kind of man-bite-dogs piece, Kevin, is your is your two black soldiers above that title. And we decided, well, if we don't, we're not getting across what's going on here. How do you think about it? How do you feel about it, Kevin?
Well, I think about it a lot, and then I also don't think about it in the sense that I think that a black writer is, of course, a black writer. I don't think there's a... It's not a permutation of anything different than being a white writer, I think. I accept.
But
that we
Ron
have
is
this
right. We wouldn't say up-and-coming white writer on, you know, at 10.
Well, yeah, perhaps you should.
Or 9, or maybe we should.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the... that, I think, is beyond sort of... yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I think she... I'm glad she asked that question. My concern is that we need to think about... For me, being a black writer means I have this amazing literary history, whether it's Gwendolyn Brooks, who, like I said, is honored in the first poem, mm-hmm. but also that history is so... wrapped up, there's also a long poem called Nicodemus in the collection, which is about an all-black town in
Kansas,
which mm-hmm. is a true fact that, you know, right after the Civil War, there were opportunities for people to move, and they basically became homesteaders. They call them exodusters, and there's a great book by that name about this phenomenon. And I guess for me, being called or being thinking of oneself or writing as a black writer means thinking about one's history, and it's not prescriptive, it's a pleasure, it's empowering for me, and it provides a kind of broader scope. I guess I'm interested not in exactly that question, but in, and not in sort of, you know, what's, what is African American and what's not, but rather what in American culture is African American. And once you start to look at that, like Ralph Ellison, I think, mm-hmm. Started thinking about, it's hard to find some place that isn't touched by African American culture, whether it is that very language. You know, cool is something I think black folks invented in a way. And also a larger sense of, you know, from music to even cinema, there is a the more early cinema involves race and some of these questions. That said, I think we have to think of what Lucille Clifton once said, and I think she said it so well. She's a poet, and she happened to pick my first book. And she said, race doesn't is there before I, and she's a black woman writer, enters the room. You know, race is there before black people come to the conversation. So perhaps you should say white writer, up and coming, when you say something like that. But I also think that it's important to dialogue about these questions. It seems to me that in a weird way, this is sort of off topic, that, you know, race and racism is sort of back in this kind of offhand way. I see a sort of coarsening of that. And I think that's really important to have a multiplicity of voices talking about this question.
There's a coarsening, maybe, but I mean, in your work, it's kind of the opposite. You're refining our sensibilities here. Rhonda, let me turn back to you with it. When we have a poet who happens to be black, but whose work is diving into the history of the Confederacy, and he's so taken with Gwendolyn Brooks and Lionel Hampton and Nicodemus, the black settlement in Kansas, I mean, is it an important signifier for us to put it there? Do we leave it blank or neutral and just wait for the reader, the listener, to fill in the blanks?
I'm a little ambivalent about it, and I think mm-hmm. that's why I called. And I mm-hmm. do appreciate Mr. Young's response to that, because I am an African-American listener, just on the record.
Great to have you.
And I think it's important to note, for all the reasons he said, I mean, I value our traditions, and I value our role in this country, and I don't think we talk about race in a complicated enough way in this country. And I'm hoping that, you know, on an aside, it's, with Barack Obama's candidacy, I hope maybe we might start to do that. But I also think that some people use it as a way to dismiss and to categorize and to reject. So that's where my ambivalence lies, is that we talk about race in such a really superficial and ridiculous way in this country that it bothers me that, I mean, that, you know, when we invoke it, it also brings up that part of it and not so much the more complicated part of
it. Yeah, there's the history and a lot of complication right with it. We like to think we use it to hold up, but you'll be the judge. Rhonda, thank you for calling. Let me take a call from North Carolina, Lumberton, North Carolina. Lawrence. Hi, Lawrence. You're on the air with Kevin Young.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
All right. My concern is, and I have your works, and I love it, and I'm going to go out and get this one as soon as I can. My concern is that 5 years defines a territory.
The 5 years of civil war, Lawrence?
Yes. 5 years of civil war defines a territory. I'm a Southerner, and most of the people that I know, whether black or white, who love the best of the South, consider themselves Southerners. And it's not that we're trying to do away with that history, but I think continually to dwell on that particular topic as Confederacy is, I think it rubs me the wrong way, and sometimes it's degrading to people who love the South.
Lawrence, may I be bold enough to ask your race?
Oh, I'm African-American.
Kevin Young, what do you say to a caller from Lumberton, North Carolina? He says 5 years, don't be stuck on that definition of the South.
Well, it's sort of 5 and 400, I think. I guess for me, it's a good point. I mean, it's tough to be a Southerner in the sense that once you have to live somewhere a long, long time and your blood has to have spilled there. You can't just have moved there for 5 minutes or 5 years. And I think the caller makes a really good point about the length of history, that there is history beyond this and since. And I guess I was interested in a history sort of both before, around, and through that. I mean, I'm interested in, both my parents are from the South. I went there quite a bit growing up every summer and Christmas. And, to me, that was just normal part of growing up, and so I don't see it as a someplace different, except for it's a fascinating, beautiful part of, I ate Southern food every day growing up, so for me, that I didn't think of it as Southern food or soul food, as some people call it. My dad always said it's just food, and
reference to the Confederacy, you see that as a way, does the South stay locked in that box in that case, or are you looking to redefine it forward?
I don't think it's equivalent to Southern, though it would be interesting to think, well, how would the book be different if it was for the Southern dead? I'm not sure it would feel the same, though there's points in the book where, like I said, there's a long poem called Guernica, which is thinking about a lynching, and I was in southern Spain when I had heard about this lynching in the south of the United States, and I was thinking about the South in general and the South across the world, and I guess that sort of question becomes complicates even more this idea of Southernness, which I really appreciate the caller bringing up, and I hope you do go out and see the book and see what you think of it. I think it really does address lots of different sides of Southernness.
Mm-hmm. Right now, Kevin, if I may, I want to go to Providence, Rhode Island. We're joined from there by Donald King. He is artistic and founding director of the Providence Black Repertory Company. He's directing the theater company's production of Black Mariah, Kevin Young's it's an adaptation for the stage of Kevin Young's noir tale in verse, premieres February 1st. Donald King is adjunct professor in the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. Mr. King, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you come across Kevin Young, and what made you decide to put his verse on stage?
Well, I came across his wonderful book. It's funny they say don't judge a book by a cover, but in this case, that was exactly what drew me to it. I came across it in the Brown University bookstore, where I was just kind of looking for a new work for our company, not necessarily something that was written for the stage, but something that we might begin to develop for the stage. And I came across his collection of noir poetry and was blown away in the aisle.
Black Mariah, I think that's the old slang for the police van that would take people away.
Indeed.
And now, how are you taking it to the stage? Do you just stand up and read? Are you dramatizing it?
Not at all, not at all. We've been developing Kevin's piece for about 2 years now. We got a grant from the NEA and from the Left Foundation most recently. And what we did is we went through a process of taking his collection of poems, which is about 79, I believe, Kevin, and kind of brought it down to about 55 last year for a stage reading, where we just sat actors on the stage. I had a music director who developed some original music for it, and we just read the piece with lights overhanging, and just to see if, you know, what I thought had some dramatic potential would work for an audience. And in fact, without staging it at all, in that reading over a three-day weekend, people loved it and said they couldn't wait to see it staged.
That's great. Let us get a little taste of it. Then we want to hear from the poet on what it feels like to see poems gone to the stage. But here's a scene from Black Mariah, where Private Eye, a.k.a. Jones, played by Aaron Andrade, has been sprung from jail by Delilah, a country girl in Kevin Young's telling, who moved to the city to make it big. A.k.a. Jones is on the run and hopes that Delilah, his secret love, will meet him and they can elope. But in this poem, he finds out that she won't show up.
My car, that dinosaur, runs on memories and other things older than the fossil fuels I tell the gas jockey to fill her up with. I toss him a few bits for his time and hope he won't recognize me and call the authorities, whosoever they may be. Before the dust from my bald tread settles, before he can wipe the grease from his hands, my skinny dime's ringing up the solicitous sheriff who rallies the posse.
Aaron Andrade there from the Providence Black Repertory Company reading from Black Mariah, Kevin Young's poem. Wow, my car, that dinosaur, runs on memories. Kevin Young, what's it feel like to hear it, see it up on stage?
It's terrific. It's a great feeling. I thought it'd be stranger than it has been to see it. I've seen a few rehearsals, and it's been terrific. One of the things that I think Don's really done a great job of is bringing many voices into one poem. You'll often hear, you know, almost like a chorus behind the poems. And it made me realize how many voices were in the poems already. I knew that. But the book is sort of structured between a detective and a femme fatale, as it were, sort of going back and forth telling their stories. But he's managed to make them coexist. And it's great to see the characters alive on stage that I sort of imagined, but then are breathing and laughing and, you know, walking around. So that's been terrific.
Fully formed in the flesh. Donald King, what about race and history? In this work, Black Mariah, in the work of Kevin Young, I mean, it's the Black Repertory Company. Is there something essentially culturally linked there that led you to bring it in?
I mean, of course, but, you know, for us, one of the reasons that also brought us to Kevin's piece is, at the end of the day, it's an American narrative, and I think that's really important. And one of our core values is interrogating and reappropriating popular narratives and mythologies surrounding race, class, gender, and culture in America.
How great.
And so what happens is, in the genre of noir, you don't see African Americans. We're not really present. We might be a Pullman porter, we might be a maid. And what Kevin has done is kind of centralized African Americans. And one of the things also in kind of going in and kind of looking at the genre, I'm not that much of a film noir buff as Kevin is, but as I began to watch it, I began to understand what Kevin has mentioned in a few interviews, that he began to see film noir very much similar to a kind of blues sensibility or blues reality. Am I right, Kevin, in saying that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think for me, I realized about halfway through the book that there was this kind of blues narrative, that there was a story of a hard luck tale of a guy trying to find a girl who couldn't, and she was bad for him but good for him. And I think that both film noir and the blues are matched and married by fate. You know, you're sort of doomed, but there's a kind of joy in the blues, and I think there's a kind of I don't say it's joy in film noir, but there's a kind of sorrow that is purgative and hopefully cathartic. Mm. So I think they both kind of tell these American stories, and I think that's a great way to put it.
Black Mariah premieres February 1st at the Providence Black Repertory Company, Providence, Rhode Island. If you're in the area, check it out. Donald King, artistic and founding director there, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and Kevin, thank you for writing a wonderful collection of poetry, and good luck on your tour.
Thanks so much, Don. Good to see you. See you soon.
Good luck with the show. Let's go to Ken in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I am actually the editor of something called quickmuse.com.
Oh, perfect.
Which is a website on which Kevin has appeared several times.
What's quickmuse.com, Ken?
You want to tell him, Kevin, or should I?
Well, I can tell you. It might. They give you a prompt. It's an online site. Obviously, it's online. So they give you a prompt, and the poet has 15 minutes to write a poem.
So get going.
Yeah.
So like they give you a starting phrase or word, and off you go?
Well, often, it's a phrase or a poem. And I did one on New Year's. He had us do four, and I did mine in one day. So I had to write four poems in one day.
Sorry, man.
Talk about
which was
prolific.
Quite fun. But, you know, it forces you to, get going. But one of the great things, I think, too, about it is that viewers can then go online and see not only the finished poem, but the software allows you to see the poem as it's written in real time. So
along the way, as you banged it out, Ken, does this four poems in one day, does that qualify as improvisation?
I think so. I mean, he was totally unprepared for it at the time. We said, yeah. go. So it was an experiment. But basically, the thing I wanted to say was that there's been a lot of talk of how Kevin Litt's music and how his poems are very cool.
Yes.
And, you know, he's sort of expanding the idea of African-American culture and all of which is centered around the idea of jazz and sort of the grace under pressure of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was wondering if he had any insights about his compositional process in doing the Quick Muse stuff. And how, you know, has he seen a difference between the kind of stuff he's doing for us as compared to the stuff that he's done in his new book?
Grace Under Pressure, time and jazz and the way you do it. What do you say, Kevin?
I think improvisation is an art. I mean, I think oftentimes we think of it as just, waking up and doing what you want. But though that, of course, is part of it. But I think improvisation is, you know, something that you have to study. And as they say, woodshed, go behind the woodshed and practice. And for me, it was fun doing the four in one day because it forced me to kind of abandon your bag of tricks.
Right.
And sort of examine that. You can get too familiar with your own writing if you let yourself. And I try to change it up. I think of myself more akin to Miles Davis, not that I can, blow like he can, but hopefully I like the way that he always changed between records and always was willing to try new things. And for me, the improvisatory quality of Quick Muse has been really great and freeing. By the end, I feel like I was writing about the writing, and about the whole process of seeing something strange. And, there were almost like a way you could start to play with the technology and put little jokes in and then erase them. And that was sort of freeing. And so, I won't tell you which one to look at, but if you check out those poems and have the time to... which we have, check it out and see, how that process works.
There's a new X-ray on the process.
These will be published in New American Writing, the literary journal New American Writing, Kevin's poems, the four of them.
Oh, that's great. Four in a day, that's a mind on fire. Ken, thanks a lot for calling. Glad you called in.
Thanks so much.
Let me get a call from New Haven, Connecticut, and Nancy. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hello,
Hi, Nancy.
Tom.
Hi.
I'm a fellow Kansan, grew up and was educated there. And
perfect.
I was curious about, I'm an artist, and I found that the landscape of Kansas certainly inspires me to paint. I like the plains and open space. I wondered whether you grew up in the rural or urban part of Kansas and whether anything about growing up there influenced your poetry in a particular way.
Great question. I grew up in Topeka, Kansas. Which is sort of both rural and I don't know if I'd call it urban, but it certainly was a great sort of big town full of small town people. And the great thing about Kansas, as you know, is even if you are in a city within 15 minutes or 5 minutes in my case or two, you could be in the middle of nowhere in a good sense, like freeing far from lights and, just the stars above you. And many a night I would drive out, being a sort of tortured teenager poet, drive out and park the car and get out and just stare at the sky. And I think that kind of big sky feeling was really important to my work. I also, when I was younger, used to write only about the sea, so there was kind of a strange disconnect being landlocked. but I also think it helped me think about what poetry is. And for me, poetry is the dirt, the everyday. And my family from Louisiana were farmers, and so there was always a connection to me to the earth. It wasn't far away, as I think we sometimes can find it.
Nancy, does he take you home, Kevin Young, there?
Pardon?
Does he take you home with that description of canvas, Nancy?
Oh, yes. Nancy? And I was from a wheat farmer family. Yes,
oh,
and
great.
That infinite blackness and darkness and flatness with just a yard light from a farm occasionally and that
right,
huge starry
right,
sky. Yes,
right.
Definitely.
Right back in Kansas. Nancy, thank you for your call. Kevin, our time begins to grow short. I wish you'd take us off in another direction entirely. Talk about cool. Talk about jazz. You've got a section called April in Paris and a poem here describing Lionel Hampton's last weekend in concert at the Hotel Meridian, Paris, Good Friday, 1999. Could you read it for us?
Yes. I happened to see Lionel Hampton this last weekend. He was performing with my father, and I wrote the poem, both have passed away, so it's sort of an inadvertent elegy to both. I'll just read half of it, the second half. Playing the subtleties of silence, Hampton traces, like a government agency, the vibes, quietly. His wands, a magic, a makeshift. Arthritic solos hover like a bee above the flower, finding the sweet center. 2 days before Easter, Monsieur Hampton plays the changes, offering up songs read off a napkin bruised with lyrics. What did I do to be so black and blue? His voice wobbles along the highway called history, flying home here. Leaves out the part I'm white inside because he's not. The band tight will swarm behind and save him if he falls when... The sax player stops between tunes to dab a handkerchief at the drool gathering his chin. Such care. The mind's blind alleys we wander down. This is enough, just. This is Paris. In the Rosa Parks section, as the drummer we met before the second set dubbed it, we stand in the back and applaud and shout yeah and block no one. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. Dad's so excited he falls off the risers and he laughs and we laugh. Skies are blue, clouds are white, sacred dark light in which after they lead him out.
Kevin Young reading from April in Paris, and there Lionel Hampton, and your own father reference there. What does your father think about my son, the poet?
Well, like I said, he passed away, but he, I think he was proud of it, that. And, you know, I think one of the qualities, and especially in my new work, I'm trying to wrestle with his passing, and I've had cause to write quite a few elegies, and you know, writing about that is sort of one of the qualities of poetry, is to memorialize. And I guess for me, this book is a monument to all the things we've been talking about, race and southernness and all these things, but also it's an elegy for my friend, the late Philippe Wamba, who died in Kenya. And so there's a whole suite of poems called African Elegy for him. And I don't know if we're short on time, but...
we're good. You know, we've got a couple of minutes. What's on your mind there?
Well, I just think that he died on the year anniversary of September 11th. So for me, that was such a strange day anyway for everyone, I think. And we were all sort of wrestling with grief and loss, and... I, as a poet, had been asked to read on that day.
And Philippe Wamba, of course, a poet himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was more of a nonfiction writer, but he was a writer. I had published him in an anthology I did, and he both wrote about Africa and the United States because his mother is African American, and his father's African. Mm. And he grew up in Tanzania and in the States. And so when he died, it was a strange moment for me because there was all this public grief and then I was faced with this private one. And I hope the poems in that section address both the public and the private and the mix of how grief makes us feel. I think we sometimes breeze right past it and don't look closely at it. And I guess for me, the poems trace a kind of season of grief of from his death to after.
And from the Civil War to a very contemporary loss But we hear it right there in the music of Lionel Hampton. It's not all grief by any means. It's a great tour. We love taking it with you, at least a little bit of it, Kevin Young. The new collection is For the Confederate Dead. We're very grateful to you for spending the time. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great fun.
Kevin Young joined us from Atlanta. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Special thanks today to Nathan Lee for his help with sound for this hour. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, by Lena Mata, Stefano Katsanas, Philip Martin, Thomas Martzall, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.